Okay, so we've got momentum conservation that came about because we had Newton's third law acting on us. So in a collision, however hard one body pushes on one, the other one pushes back. So the result is that the total momentum has to be a constant in those circumstances, where for unknown reasons, we denote momentum by P, and it's just the mass times the velocity. Typically, we've done problems that everything's in a line. We've done one problem here, for example, where we're using the vector nature of momentum. But in all cases where we have no external force, we expect the initial momentum to equal the final momentum. In the quizzes we had just a second ago, we had inelastic collisions where things were stuck together, so final velocities were the same. Those are kind of the particularly easy sort of question because you can kind of immediately factor out this final velocity and you've got a formula for the final velocity right off the bat. The elastic collisions, I would say, are more complicated. If we just write it down, it's saying this kind of complicated quadratic thing, which is hard to deal with. But we showed that that was equivalent to this linear equation, which is way easier to deal with. So typically what we're going to end up with is two linear equations to solve. And that's not so bad. So this isn't a particularly important example, but it's one we did in class, where initially one of the objects was at rest, and we came up with those final velocities. We also worked the problem where we had two guys coming together with equal and opposite velocities. But any sort of possibility, any sort of initial velocities, we can solve using this equation and that equation. Questions? Well, we've kind of reached the middle of this course, and pretty much from here on out, we're going to be dealing with applications of these basic principles. So the basic principles that we're going to be applying again and again and again are F equals ma, Newton's second law, and conservation of energy. If we don't have friction, and if we do have friction, then we're going to have a change in energy that's given by the work by the non-conservative forces. And if we have no external forces, then we have conservation of momentum. Now we have one thing that's slightly new. We've talked about it before a little bit, and that's the case of something that's moving in a circle. So circular motion happens pretty commonly, so it kind of deserves its own little story. And what we said long ago is that for circular motion, the velocity is changing even if the speed isn't, right? Because you're going in different directions. So since the velocity is changing, there is an acceleration, and it's towards the center of the circle. And the book shows, I'm not going to repeat that argument, that the centripetal acceleration is equal to the speed squared divided by r. Now what makes these circular motion problems a little bit tricky is they're kind of the opposite of what we're used to. So heretofore, mostly, we wrote down what the forces were, and from that we found the acceleration. But in a circular motion problem, we know the acceleration, and so we can use that to calculate the forces. Right, typically one missing force that's wasn't specified in the problem. So it's kind of the opposite of how things normally work. So, I don't know, let's take a look at kind of a typical sort of example. So here we have a potential circular motion. If I start this ball here, it's just going to oscillate back and forth. If there weren't any friction, of course, however high it started, it would go to the same height on the other side. Because what's happening when it's instantaneously stopped is it has no kinetic energy, so all its energy has to be potential energy, and so the initial potential energy has to equal the final potential energy, so H has to equal H. Okay, so let's put it up a little bit higher. So it tried to go around this curve, and it didn't quite make it. If we go higher still, it came close to making that curve. Right? You could see it wasn't really probably in contact with the track on this upper level. If I put it all the way up here, it's pretty clearly in contact all the way along. So we might ask the question, where exactly could we start this marble so that it would be just barely in contact when it's on this top surface? So if it's just barely in contact, if it's flying like it was a moment ago, not actually contacting it, then of course the only force on it is gravity. If it's making strong contact with that upper surface, then of course there's a normal force that's pushing it down in addition to gravity. In this kind of critical case where it's just barely in contact, then the only force on it is gravity. The normal force has gone to zero under those sort of circumstances. So what we have then is an object that's moving in a circle. So here's our track. So at this point, we've got no normal force, but we do have a force of gravity on it. And this ball is executing a piece of a curve, you know, that is very similar to that piece of the curve of a chalk. How fast does it need to be going in order to have this situation occur? Well, we know that since it's moving in a circle, it has to have an acceleration. And that acceleration is the centripetal acceleration, where r is the radius of the circle. So the sum of the forces has to be the mass times the acceleration. And the only force is gravity. So it must be that the speed that we need at the top of the loop has to be given by v squared is g times r. Now, if we want to figure out how high we need to start it, that's a problem for conservation of energy. So if I declare that the top of the hoop is height equals zero, then at this point, we have no height and hence no potential energy. At this point, we have kinetic energy that is 1/2 mv squared. And we know that v squared has to be rg. At this starting point, it has no kinetic energy because I'm starting it at rest. And it has a potential energy that is mgh, where we don't know what h is yet. So the total initial energy is all potential energy. And at the final state, all of the energy is kinetic energy. And if there's no friction, the initial energy has to equal the final energy. And you can see that this thing applies to marbles and steelies just as well. The mass cancels out. Doesn't matter whether we do this on Mars or on the Earth, the G cancels out. So the height that we need to start it at is about half the radius. So I know we can test that out. So here's that the top of the curve. And I don't know, so that's probably a radius, so half a radius is there. So I need to start it kind of at this sort of spot. I'm actually unhappy. I didn't want it to work. I must have cheated somehow. So why didn't I want it to work? Well, we'll learn in the next chapter that not all of the kinetic energy, so that's about fair. It looks too far, though, to me. I don't know, you could have a better view at it than me. Does it actually look like it's just that far above? No, it doesn't. Okay, try it again. So that's probably a radius, so half a radius is there. Does that look like half that radius up?
I think you're
I'm cheating?
Yeah.
Okay, well. Okay, there it didn't work, so. I'm moderately happy. So if this thing were sliding, it turns out that this would be an accurate calculation. But because it's rolling, So there's kinetic energy not just in its motion, but in its rotation. We've made kind of a slight error in our calculation. But at least theoretically, for sliding, this would be the right result.
So in this case, we don't have to calculate any friction force?
So I'm assuming that there's no frictional force, but you can see there is some frictional force. So that's another reason that it probably wouldn't work. But the friction isn't huge. It goes for a good long time. More questions? So kind of another standard example is to think about a racetrack where we have a banked curve. So I think it's clear that the reason we have a banked curve is to keep the cars from flying off the track. Currently, of course, if there were no friction, this car would slide down the track. But if it's going really fast, it's going to need a frictional force in order to cause a centripetal acceleration. So let's start by calculating how fast you need to go on a banked curve if there's no friction, if it's icy. What's the right speed to hit it at? Okay, so here's our banked curve. And this is a flat, but I am thinking about it as being part of a circle. And here are my two tires. Here's my car. Pretty, isn't it? So this thing is moving in a horizontal circle. And so the centripetal acceleration is pointing right to the center of that circle. So the acceleration is pointing just like that. This thing has a mass, so it's going to have a weight. And there's going to be a normal force pushing up from the track. But we're assuming no frictional force. So the sum of these forces has to produce the acceleration. And we know that the acceleration is the centripetal acceleration. It's v squared over r. So we're back to free body diagrams again. And kind of the rules state that you should, if possible, choose axes that align with as many of the things as possible. So two out of the things are aligned to kind of the normal coordinate system. And the other rule is to try and pick the acceleration along a coordinate axis. And that's also going to be satisfied if we don't use the tilted coordinate system. If we use a coordinate system that is normal. Okay, if we do that, usually in this thing we have to break gravity up into its x and y components. But now it's the normal force that needs to be separated out into its x and y components. Yeah, I don't know, you remember all of this tricky stuff about angles, that this angle was the same as that angle, the same as that angle. So this horizontal component of the normal force, it's the only force in the x direction. So that's what's causing this acceleration. And of course, this normal force, this component of the normal force, is the normal force times the sine of theta. This vertical component, exactly vertical component of the normal force, it's adjacent to theta. So that's equal to the normal force times the cosine of the angle. So if we look at the sum of the forces in the x direction, the only force is that piece of the normal force. So we have the normal force times the sine of theta better be equal to the mass times the acceleration. In the vertical direction, we have no acceleration, right? There's no component of acceleration in the y direction. So this force minus this force has to add up to zero. So n cosine theta minus mg has to be zero. Well, we can solve, we don't know what the normal force is. We can solve for what the normal force is from this guy. So if we put the mg on the other side of the equation and divide by cosine theta, we've got that. And we can then plug that version of the normal force into that equation. So we've got mg divided by cosine theta times the sine of theta better equal m v squared over r. So You know, one thing that's good is that all the cars can hit the curve at the same speed, right? Because the mass cancels out. You may like to simplify this a little bit. Sine over cosine is tangent. So the final result then is that g times r times the tangent of theta, that needs to equal your speed squared. If you go too slow, you're going to need a frictional force to keep you from sliding down. If you go too fast, you're going to need a frictional force to keep you from going off the track on the top level. So what's that? What's that extra frictional force that would be required if we have it? Well, so it's back to drawing free body diagrams. So here's our incline. Here are my two tires. They're awfully tall tires, but so I still have gravity that's going down. I still have a centripetal acceleration that's going exactly horizontally. I've got a normal force that is perpendicular to the surface. And I don't know, just arbitrarily, let me think about me going around the curve too fast. So I actually need the frictional force to be pushing me like that. Well, this is the first time that we've had kind of a match. So if you look at it, there are two things that are aligned with a tilted coordinate system, and there are two things that are aligned with the normal coordinate system. So it's not clear which one's going to be best. But since we've always taken the acceleration to be along one axis, I'm not going to do that this time, just so you can see how it would work if you wanted to do that. So let's use the tilted coordinate system, even though it's going to cause a little bit of extra problem with the acceleration, just to see how we would handle it. Okay, so in terms of the geometry, that's the bank angle that we've been talking about. So alternating interior angles have the same angle. So this angle between the acceleration and the x-axis is also theta. And we've seen that this angle there is also theta. Some of the forces in the x direction has to equal the mass times the acceleration in the x direction. And there is an acceleration in the x direction, right? This piece of the acceleration is in the x direction. The sum of the forces in the y direction has to give me the acceleration in the y direction. And there is a piece of the acceleration in the y direction, that piece. So now I have to break the acceleration and gravity up into its two components in the x and y direction. This piece of the acceleration is going to be the acceleration times the sine of theta. This piece of the acceleration is going to be the acceleration times the cosine of theta. For the usual inclined plane problem, we've broken up gravity lots of times into its x and y components. This piece that's pushing down the plane is mg sine theta, and this piece is mg cosine theta. Okay, so some of the forces in the x direction equals the acceleration in the x direction. This force is in the x direction, purely x direction, so it's mg sine theta. The frictional force is in the x direction, positive x direction. And that all has to equal the mass times the acceleration in the x direction, which is the acceleration times cosine of theta. In the y direction, the normal force is, all of the normal force is in the positive y direction. This piece of gravity is in the negative y direction. Some of the forces in the y direction has to be the mass times the acceleration in the y direction. Now, coefficient of friction is the ratio of the frictional force to the normal force. And I can solve this top equation for the frictional force if I just bring that term to the other side of the equation. So the frictional force is ma cosine theta minus mg sine theta. And the normal force Kind of the same thing applies. I can move that term over to the other side of the equation. So there I'm going to get ma sine theta plus mg cosine theta. So once again, notice that it doesn't matter whether you're in a Toyota or you're in a truck. Everyone needs the same coefficient of friction in order to complete the curve. And of course, we know what the acceleration is. It's the speed squared divided by r. So if you calculate it, if you know your speed and you calculate this coefficient of friction, and it's more than what's really there, then you're in trouble. You're going to go off the track.
That's f over n?
Yes.
So then when you're solving for friction, you'd have to multiply the n by everything on the right?
Yeah, it is true that the frictional force is mu times n. But we don't really want the frictional force. We want the coefficient of friction. More questions.
And you wouldn't have to go that way, like you can do it with respect of A.
You're talking about in terms of my axes?
Yeah.
You gotta get the same answer no matter what coordinate systems you choose. And by my rules, I should have chosen the other one, right? Because it was equal by the first criteria and I could have had A along the x-axis if I'd wanted to. But I wanted to do one problem where I didn't do that. And it's usually not horribly. Once you know this game that you can separate accelerations just like you're doing forces, it's not fundamentally different. More questions? Well, particularly after a quiz, people like to have the opportunity to embarrass their professor. And so here we've got a system that's literally held together by duct tape. And I claim I'm going to put this over my head. So we'll see if I can do that without, in fact, having the water dump on me. You can see I'm dry, so I must have succeeded for the first class. So it's over my head, but the water is not falling out. Stopping is actually usually more interesting than continuing. So what's going on here? Why doesn't the water fall out? Well, I think probably your initial answer is centrifugal force, but I hope you remember I told you that that's a swear word in this course. You don't want to use that on your test. It's the C word. Don't use it. So how can we explain what's going on here? So I think you can imagine that if... Here's where I do my Superman impersonation. It usually works better. So I think you can imagine that if Superman had this glass of water and he pushed it down faster than it wanted to fall, it would stay in the glass. It would be constantly pushed to the bottom because he would be pushing it faster than it wanted to fall. And that's what's happening at the top of this arc. It may not look like this thing is accelerating, but it is accelerating. It has a centripetal acceleration. And its centripetal acceleration is more than g. And so just like the case here where the centripetal acceleration was more than g, there had to be a force that was actually pushing it down. Okay. So there are lots of kind of tricky questions we can have with centripetal acceleration. But do notice this fundamental reversion once we're talking about these sorts of problems. Right? So now we're talking about typically using the known acceleration to calculate a missing force. So for example, we could calculate what the normal force has to be at the top of this curve if I know how fast it's going. I know the acceleration, I know the net force, I know part of that force is gravity. The missing force has to be being caused by the normal force, pushing it down. Okay. So centripetal acceleration is kind of the middle of this chapter. I think it's the hard part of this chapter. That's why I've started with it. I hope the easier part of this chapter is the start. And it should be pretty much the same as what we were doing back in chapter 2. So in chapter 2, we were talking about an object's position and an object's velocity and an object's acceleration. And we defined for 5 minutes the average velocity as being the change in position divided by the change in time. But really quickly, we got interested in the instantaneous velocity, which was just where we were looking at the little bit of change over a real small period of time. Right? If the velocity is changing, if I take a small enough period of time, it'll be relatively constant. And same thing for acceleration. We looked at the change in velocity with respect to time for the average acceleration. But really quickly, we started talking about the instantaneous acceleration. And what we want to do is basically just wrap x around something that's rotating. So instead of talking about the linear position, I'm going to talk about what angle this thing has rotated through. And if I've got an angle that things have rotated through, I can talk about an angular velocity. Right? So usually we denote angles by theta. I can denote an angular velocity, which is the change in angle with respect to time. And I could talk about an average angular velocity, but you know that really we're going to be interested in the instantaneous angular velocity. And we've kind of started using Greek letters. So for the angular velocity, we're going to use the letter that looks like a W but is an omega. So this is angular velocity. And we're going to have angular acceleration, right? The Greek letter for A is alpha. That's going to be the change in the angular velocity divided by time. Now, here, we almost always use metric units, but it didn't matter. We could use feet, we could use furlongs, we could use light years. We could use any unit we wanted to, and all of this stuff was the same. And the same thing applies here. You can measure your angles in degrees. You can measure your angles in revolutions. You can measure your angle in radians. All of these things are equally valid. Now, for the case of constant acceleration, we derived a bunch of equations, right? So we said, for example, that delta x was equal to the initial velocity times time plus 1/2 at squared. That same equation has to be true for angles, where we have constant angular acceleration. So the change in angle has to be equal to the initial angular velocity plus 1/2 alpha t squared. We said that the speed was increasing with time according to the acceleration. So the angular speed has to be increasing according to the angular acceleration. Then we had some of the more complicated sorts of equations. Like we said that the speed squared was equal to the initial speed squared plus twice the acceleration times delta x. It has to apply right over to the angular case. So the angular velocity has to be twice the initial angular velocity squared plus 2 times alpha times delta theta. And the equation that I like, that it's in the book, but it isn't kind of a boxed version of it, that was that you could calculate the average velocity either way. You could take delta x and divide it by the time, or you could literally just average the initial speed and the final speed. And that also is going to follow right over to this equation. Okay, so there isn't anything fundamentally new about these sorts of problems. Right? So you can take a linear problem and you can match it to an angular problem and you work it exactly the same. Exactly the same equations, just now with Greek letters as opposed to Latin letters. So I've been stressing that you can use any units you want for angular measurement. And that probably the most common one to use is revolutions. The most common way of measuring angular velocities is in RPMs. If you have a tach on your car, tachometer on your car, typically it's going to be measuring the engine's rotation rate in revolutions per minute, in RPMs. For some problems, though, it does matter what units that you're going to use. And those are cases where we're relating the angle to the distances along the edge, to the circumference. And if and only if we use radian measure, there's a relationship between the arc length and the corresponding angle. And if that's true, then changes in that same thing have to be true. So that the tangential speed has to be r times omega. And the tangential acceleration has to be r times alpha. So these equations are only when you're using radians. Everything else, it doesn't matter whether you're using radians or whether you're using degrees. Let's talk a little bit about this acceleration, because we've now talked about two types of acceleration. When something is going around in a circle, we've talked about there being a centripetal acceleration, but if it's not going at a constant rate, if it's going faster and faster and faster, in addition to the centripetal acceleration, there'll be a tangential acceleration. And that's what this A is. It's the tangential acceleration, how much faster this thing is going in the tangential as opposed to center pointing direction. Okay, so there's maybe one last equation to write up. So I've always been writing that the acceleration is V squared over R. But sometimes you know things in terms of omegas as opposed to v's. So not uncommonly, we'll substitute in that v is equal to r times omega. But this better be in radians per second. So another formula for the centripetal acceleration is omega squared r. But only when we're using omega in radians a second. Questions? Let's take a look at some homework type problems. So let's start with this guy, which is 71. So in 71, we have something that is going around in a circle. And they tell us the speed that it's going at is 6 meters a second. But there's kind of some funny geometry that's going on. It's being supported simultaneously by two strings, one on the top and one on the bottom. So the geometry is we've got two strings that are pulling it like that, but this thing is in fact going in a circle. And we're supposed to calculate what these tensions are in the upper and the lower string. Now, this thing is happening on Earth, so there's another force that's present, namely the force of gravity. And since it's going in a circle, we know that the acceleration has to be pointing towards the center of that circle. It has to be going like that. And so it's a matter then of setting up a coordinate system and then setting the sum of the forces in the x and y direction separately equal to the mass times the acceleration. Now, I don't know, this may look like it's a right angle, but in fact in this problem it's not a right angle. So the only things that are square are the acceleration and the weight. So we might as well use the usual coordinate system, except maybe with the x going the other way, in order to break our forces up into their various pieces. So in terms of the y direction, there's a piece of tension that's in the y direction. Now let me draw it over here. If I knew this angle theta, I'd be all set. And I can figure out that angle from geometry, but let's just hold off on getting a numerical value for it. So this vertical force, it's opposite that angle theta, so it's going to be T1 times the cosine of theta. There's a downward force of tension due to T2, and if you look, this is an equilateral triangle, so that angle has to be the same as this angle. So this has to be T2 times the cosine of theta. Oops. You let me get away with that. Right? It's a side opposite, so those are sines. So there's no component of acceleration in the y direction. We've got three forces that are in the y direction. If we add up the forces in the y direction, T1 is upward, T2 is downward, and mg is 100% downward, and there's no acceleration in the y direction, so we've got that equation. In the x direction, we've got a piece of T1 that's in the x direction, T1 cosine theta, and we have T2 that's also pointing in the x direction, and that has to equal the mass times the acceleration. Now I could figure out what the acceleration is, but I like one letter as opposed to two, right? It is going to be v squared over r. But let's just hold off on calculating what it is precisely. Okay, so I haven't actually calculated the numerical value of the angle, but I can calculate it from the geometry. So I know the sine of the angle, I know the cosine of the angle, I know the mass, I know g, I know the speed, and I could calculate the radius. So the only things that are unknown are the tensions in those two strings that are supporting the system. So it's two equations and two unknowns, which sounds pretty good. So I'll call it simplify these equations. Notice that of course we're going to put the mg to the other side of the equation, and we have a common factor of sine here, which I can factor out. And if I move that over also to the other side of the equation, I have the difference between the tensions is mg divided by the sine of theta. Same thing applies here. I've got two cosines. I can factor those out and put it to the other side of the equation. So I have T1 plus T2 is MA divided by the cosine of the angle. And once I've got them in that form, it's real easy to solve them, because if I just add these equations, the T2s are going to cancel out. So I'm going to get that twice the tension in the upper string is equal to mg divided by the sine of the angle plus the acceleration divided by the cosine of the angle. So we've got T1 if I actually now numerically calculate these angles.
So what did you do between those two steps? You had the T1 minus T2 and T1 plus T2.
Yeah.
You added those together.
So here, yes, so between here and here and there?
Yeah,
I just added these two equations. So let's calculate our angle theta. So here's our triangle, and we know that the whole thing is 3, so this piece of it is 1.5. So the sine of the angle has to be the opposite side of the hypotenuse. So of course theta is the inverse sine of 1.5 divided by 2. And I've got Pythagoras going for me, so whatever this radius is, I know that 1.5 squared plus the radius squared better be 2 squared. So the radius better be the square root of 2 squared minus 1.5 squared. So, and they tell us the speed, so I've got the acceleration, I've got the angle, I've got g, I've got mass. I can calculate that tension. Okay, so kind of the reverse of normal. We've got the acceleration. We're calculating forces. We knew the acceleration because the problem said it was moving in a circle, and we know that things moving in a circle have an acceleration that's towards the center of the circle. It tells us right in the problem.
Oh.
6 meters a second. And I hope it's clear that if it's spinning faster and faster and faster, those tensions are going to have to get bigger and bigger and bigger. More questions? So that's kind of a centripetal motion problem. Let's take a look at a kind of standard chapter 2 in angles sort of problem. So here we have a washer, and it's going to, starting from rest, it's going to reach an angular speed of 5 revolutions per second during 8 seconds. And then we're going to turn off the washer, and it's going to slow down to rest in 12 seconds. And they ask us what angle did it turn through during this whole process. So again, graphically, if we were to look at the angular velocity versus time, speeds up for 8 seconds and it reaches an angular velocity of 5 revs per second. And then over 12 seconds, which means a total of 20 seconds, but over 12 seconds it's going to go back down to 0. And they want us to calculate the total angle that it's gone through. And you remember that stack of graphs, right? So if we had a graph that was x versus time and velocity versus time and acceleration versus time, going down the stack was derivative or slope, going up the stack was area under or integration. So here I've got angular velocity, so the area under this curve has to tell me what the angle is. But let's not work it that way to start with. If we're going to work it in a more straightforward way, we're going to break it up into two pieces. And during this first piece, we have constant positive angular acceleration. And so we can use that the change in angle per time is the average of the initial and final angular velocity. So what we would get then is for this first piece, call it A, the change in angle would be the final velocity plus the initial velocity divided by 2 times the 8 seconds. In terms of units, we've got 5 revolutions per second divided by 2 times 8 seconds. So we're going to get out revolutions, and we get 20 revolutions. For the second piece, call it B, we can use the same equation. Now the final angular speed is 0, and the initial angular speed is 5, right? We're starting from this point. So the angular speed has to be 0 plus 5 divided by 2, all times 12 seconds. So 60 divided by 2 is 30. So 30 revs. So 30 plus 20 is 50. So I claim that the total angle it spins through is 50 revolutions.
Going from 8 to 12, wouldn't it be only 4 seconds is the change in time?
No. So what you said is correct, but I think you're not understanding the problem. So this whole interval is 12 seconds. And this whole interval is 20 seconds. Okay, so the quote-unquote faster way is to realize that this is a triangle, and the area of a triangle is half the base times the height. The base is 20 seconds. The height is 5 seconds. Half of it, we get the same answer, 50 revs. So here we have archaeologist who is going to swing across a river and on a vine that's 10 meters long, and the speed at the bottom, right? This is the Tarzan problem. Speed at the bottom is 8 meters a second, and the question is the vine able actually to support him? So if you think about this, at the center of the, at the minimum position, the vine doesn't just have to support his weight, it also has to supply enough tension, because we know that the acceleration is towards the center of the circle. So the tension in the string minus mg has to be equal to the total force in the y direction, which is the acceleration. So the required tension is the mass times the acceleration. The acceleration is the speed, which was 8. And the radius was 10. And we've got mg. And we can get his mass is 85. And g is, of course, 9.8. Now we can factor out the mass, I guess. So we get 85 times 8 squared divided by 10 plus 9.8. 8 squared is 64, divided by 10 is 6.4, so it's 6.4 plus 9.8. All times 85, and it's too much. The required tension is 1377 newtons. Okay. So it's back. So part of this, this is all, I guess, back to the future. Part of this is back to chapter 2, where we just have angles as opposed to x's. And part of this is back to free body diagrams, except now we have a known acceleration, and we're typically going to end up calculating forces. Questions? Yes.
So in that problem, do we use the, wait, where was the 10 used? The acceleration for the meters long, the line length? Where, how did we do that?
So that, the acceleration was v squared over r. So that's where the r came in. 8 meters a second is pretty fast. He had to have a pretty large swing in order to get that much velocity. Questions? Well, I don't know. So we've got 2 minutes for iQuiz question, I guess. And this is an old iQuiz question. So this is one that mostly is how to interpret position versus time graphs. So it says at time equals 0, a stationary box on a frictionless floor explodes into two pieces. Piece 1 has a mass of 1 kilogram, piece 2 has a mass of 2 kilograms. Which of these graphs displays the possible position versus time? No takers so far. So remember how these position versus time things work, right? So what's the velocity of this guy? Positive or negative? And this one? So this is where something at rest, both of the pieces go forward, right? That can't be, right? Explosions have to have a piece that goes backwards and a piece that goes forward. So if it's not A, it must be B, C, or D. So I see some C's. So what C is saying is that as fast as one goes forward, two goes backwards. But they have different masses, right? So you remember the problem of the guy pushing off the other guy. Remember that Iquiz problem? So, and the lighter guy has to have more velocity since he has to have the same momentum. So the lighter guy, which is number one, has to have more speed, which requires us to have B. Okay, so come one, come all tonight.
Right here?
Here, yep.